Good Chodesh, right? Rosh Chodesh Adar. Shnichnas Adar Marbin Besimcha. So I guess the request based upon our last time was to discuss about the Emunah, faith during difficult times. And tonight's class is dedicated in loving memory of Sarah Sarabat Amos. Very special lady from our community whose Shloshim was, am I correct? It was Sunday. Yeah. Sunday was the Shloshim. Okay, so I guess we to phrase the discussion for tonight to understand what makes something difficult. We talk about having difficult times. So probably suffering, right? You know, things, those are definitely the things that do it. You know, we look and see, it seems like the grass is always green on the other side. You know, I look to see what people around me, it seems everything's so wonderful. You know, my friend Rabbi Kamen told me a story. A person comes to the psychologist, says, you know, telling all his problems. I wish I could be just like my neighbor. He's Mr. Perfect. And the shrink is laughing because Mr. Perfect is a 7:30 appointment that night, right? You know, everyone's got their own peklach. My mother, she should be well. She just tells a story growing up. There's no real source, but the idea is very profound. You know, you get up to heaven and your whole life you're carrying your bag of troubles. And you can put down the bag and you can pick up anyone else's bag. There you go. So you're walking around and you have all different bags and you pick up and you try to find the lightest one, has the least amount of troubles. So when you go and you pick the bag you want, you find out that you took the bag you were carrying your whole life. That's the lesson, that what we think is so much easier. So what we define as suffering, or everyone else seems to have it so better. First of all, it's not necessarily true. We don't know what goes on behind closed doors. We don't know what types of issues people are dealing with. Well, everything might look like the Barbie doll, or Ken and Barbie, whatever the, you know, Hollywood. It's really not that way. And I think it's just one important thing to keep in mind. Also, I guess when talking about suffering, you know, why do people suffer? So there's 25 reasons why people suffer. And each one of them is a good reason. It's hard for us to be able to pinpoint and say, for this particular person, this is the reason why they're suffering. We don't know. We could talk maybe on a national level, why the Jewish people suffer. Well, that's clear. The Torah says that if you keep the mitzvot, thing will be well. If you don't keep the mitzvot, there'll be punishments. That's a communal level. But the question of suffering really is, if suffering bothers us, and some suffering bothers us and some suffering doesn't bother us, though the types of suffering questions that bother us are when good people suffer. When a bad person suffers, it doesn't bother us, right? If Osama bin Laden would fall down a flight of stairs and become paralyzed from the it wouldn't bother us, right? When evil people suffer, that's not what bothers us. The question arises when we see good people who are suffering. That's what really, you know, we struggle with, and that becomes a test in our emunah, and why is Hashem doing this? When we find suffering that's concentrated into one place, to one people, at one particular time, those questions bother us. When you have 6 million people who are murdered within 6 years in one particular location in Europe, that bothers us. If it would not have been that, if we could have changed the suffering factor somehow and spread it out, so it wouldn't have been over 6 years, it would over 60 years, 600 years, 6,000 years. And it wouldn't have been just in one continent, it would have been spread over every continent. These types of questions don't bother us. When a child stubs their toe, which a child suffers because of that, that's suffering. Somehow that suffering doesn't bother us. But other levels, more intense levels of suffering, more concentrated levels of suffering, that bothers us. But the question really is, how could God cause anything to suffer? And there's many, many answers to this. Guilt. Who says that we don't know why? People might be guilty, might have done mistakes, might have done the wrong things. Another potential answer is for free will. In order for free will to really exist, not just to be a bunch of robots, so by definition, innocent people have to suffer, and bad people have to prosper. We'll go through sources and try to analyze this, because if not, we're not choosing good for the sake of choosing good. Right? We're making a choice. I'm doing the good because that's what's pleasurable to me. I'm avoiding things. If a person would, do something wrong and a lightning bolt would come in and zap them, so then free will goes out the window. So these are other issues. When there's a concept, we spoke about classes a few years ago, we talked about the concept of reincarnation. When people suffer, they might not have done technically anything wrong in this particular time on Earth.
But who knows what happened in previous lifetimes and other things. So there's many different reasons we can give to you. We can never say with certainty why something is happening, but as we talk about the issue of suffering, just try to frame within that background. A few sources, if you look at the first one here, is the Ramchal. The Ramchal was Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. He was a great rabbi. He lived in the 1700s in Italy. He was such a great rabbi that the Vilna Gaon himself learned 22 hours a day. He took 4 half-hour naps. He used to learn. He used to, even when it was daylight outside, the Vilna Gaon used to learn by candlelight. He'd bring the shades down. He wouldn't get distracted by what's going on outside, right? We get so distracted by what's happening in our pockets with the buzzes and the beeps. He don't want to get distracted by anything that's going on, so he used to close the shades and learn by candlelight for 22 hours a day, 4 like half-hour naps. So the Vilna Gaon said about the Ramchal, the first source is if he was alive in his day, he would have traveled from Europe, he would have walked in by foot just to learn from him. That's how great. So when the Vilna Gaon is on this level, and he talks about the Ramchal, we have no really appreciation, no real understanding of how great he was. But he lays down some of the most fundamental core ideas of Judaism in his book called Derech Hashem, The Way of God. So the source says, every Jew must know and believe that there exists a first being, God, without beginning or end, who brought all things into existence and continues to sustain him. This being is God. Now we, from the way we're created, it's no fault of our own, but we work within time and space. We can't comprehend something that doesn't fit into time and space. It's like, we don't have the tools to do that. It would be like, I don't know, trying to use a hammer when you use a screwdriver. We don't have the tools. Our brains don't function. I can't picture something that's beyond time, beyond space. But there is something called God. So by definition, we're limited in understanding, but we believe that there is brings everything into existence, brings me and you and the table and the shtender and everything comes into existence. That's called God. So now, that's the baseline. When we're talking about having emunah, the baseline is that we're believing in somebody called God, something called God. Right? It's hard to talk about God. All we can really say is what God isn't. We don't have any proper vocabulary words to describe God. We can just say, God doesn't have a body. God isn't limited by this. He's not that. He's not that. But it's hard to talk in the positive terms. We say he's omnipresent. He's omnipotent. All powerful. He's everywhere. But sometimes it just sounds like vocabulary words that we tried to like memorize when we were little kids, like to sound sophisticated, omnipresent, omnipotent. What does it really mean? God's everywhere. Like the air we breathe, like fills the whole space that we inhabit. So the next source is Rav Volpe. Rav Volpe, the Alei Shor, was a mashgiach in the yeshiva. Mashgiach's job is to be like a spiritual coach to help and encourage the boys and to help them and to deal with them. So he has a lot of interesting philosophical ideas and character improvement. So he writes in his book, in Alei Shor, God knows everything that happens to all of creation every moment in time. Even when a leaf falls from a tree, God fills the entire world like the soul fills the entire body. There's no place where he's absent. God guides the world. He wants the continuity of the world in every individual. As the Ramban teaches, he runs the world according to principles of reward and punishment based upon the individual's free will decisions. So that's part of it. We have free will. So if I were to ask you, why do you think it's important to have free will? It's a good question, right? Why do you think it's important for us to have free will? We'd be like a bunch of robots, right? Yeah. Does God have any robots right now? Malachim, he's got angels. He doesn't need more angels. He needs me and you. So it's much more of a meaningful existence for God to give us the choice to make decisions. If he didn't, it'd be a game. It'd be like a automatic pilot. It'd be just a joke. There was a famous story told of Rabbi Shalom Shwadran. He's a very great teacher in Israel, and he gave a class. I don't know, maybe like a women's class like this. He gave a class, and one of the regulars for the class stopped coming. And he asked him, he said, is everything okay? I haven't seen you. He said, no. He says, I'm not going to be here for the next week's class, but in 2 weeks from now, I'm going to be back every week. I'm going to be back there. He says, is everything okay? Do you need something? He goes, well, like hemming and hawing, you don't really tell the rabbi. He says, but I follow soccer. It turns out, like every week when we have our class, there's a soccer match then. And the next week is like the, I don't know if it was the World Cup or what it was. It's like the grand finale, then the season's over, then in 2 weeks I'll be coming back. So Rabbi Shadran said, well, can you explain to me, how does soccer work? I never heard about this. So he says, well, there's two teams, and there's a goalie, and the ball, you have to kick it into the other team's goal. And then that's how the game is. The whole point is to kick the ball into the other one's goal. So he goes, that must be such a miserable existence. The goalie has to live by the there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, protecting the goal. He goes, no. The game only goes for a few hours. He says, Rosh Hashanah, oh, that's excellent. I have an idea. Why don't you and I go to the field right now? We'll go kick some balls in. We'll get some points right now. We'll kick the ball. The goalie's not there. He went home to his wife and kids. He's not guarding the goal. You and I, we'll win the game. We'll do it. I thought you were pretty smart. You don't understand how the game works. It only counts when there's an obstacle to overcome. You only get a point if the goalie's there. If there's no goalie, there's no point. There's no game. There's no point to any of this. So at that point, Rosh Hashanah smiled. He hooked him. Listen to what you're saying. There's no point if there's no goalie, if there's no obstacle to overcome. If there's no obstacle and you do the right thing, it's like kicking the ball into an empty net. It's pointless. The person got the rabbi's message, and then the next week, when it was the time for the Torah class, he came to the class. He didn't go watch the sporting game. When he walked into the room, so Rabbi Shvedran stood up out of respect for the fact that he made this tremendous sacrifice for him. That was his free will struggle, right? That was his struggle. Again, for somebody else, that might be a joke. For other people, it might be a very difficult thing. Wouldn't be able to pass the test. But everybody has their own level of free choice where they're struggling at. Everyone's on a personal journey where their ladder is. But that's why free will matters. Because if you don't have free will, it's meaningless. It's worse than a spiritual robot. It's a joke. So part of the free will comes into that as a context for that. And because we have free will, so then it makes sense to talk about reward and punishment. If I do the right thing, even when I had a temptation, an unhealthy desire that's inside of me, and we do have that, we can't deny it, we have desires to do, to say, to behave in ways that are unhealthy, inappropriate, toxic, but we don't. When we overcome that, so then that's what you can talk about getting a reward. To get a reward for not doing anything, it's a joke. So as you look in the, we'll skip the next page. The Rambam talks a little bit about this. But I want to talk a little bit about, there's a Gemara on the next page in Brachos, which says that we have everything is in the hands of heaven. Hakol b'dei shemayim chutz miyir ha-shemayim. That everything is in the hands of God, except for how much we choose to fear God. So the Tosfos and the Rashi explain this. You know, none of us were upstairs and made a request. You know exactly how tall we want to be, what color hair we want to have, what color eyes, how smart we want to be, how rich we want to be. None of us had any say in that. Into family we're born into, what neighborhood we were born into. Some people are born in Bnei Brak, a religious neighborhood. They're born with a Gemara in their lap. Other people are born on some farm in Nebraska. Hashem sends Jewish neshamas into different places because they have a different purpose, a different goal. None of us chose where we're going to land. That's not free will. The free will is how you play the hand you're dealt, right? When Hashem says, this is what I want from you, I don't know why, but Hashem put you in this particular circumstance, that's what it means. That everything is in the hands of heaven except for your fear of heaven. What you choose to do with your background and your knowledge and your talents. So the Tosfos tells you in the case, if someone's going to stand in front of it's a blizzard outside, they stand outside in shorts and a t-shirt and they catch a cold, they say, what do you mean? You use your free will and you made a poor choice. At certain points, a person can make so many bad choices, they'll lose their free will. It's an extreme case, but you see that in the Torah, right? By the first five makos, Hashem punishes the plagues. So the first five says that Hashem hardened, that Paro hardened his heart, and that was Hashem hardened his heart. The last 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, he didn't have free will anymore. So it's a hard philosophical thing to understand. You know, how could a person lose their free will? That's not fair. You know, if someone would decide to, go to the Grand Canyon. It's great. I mean, have you guys ever been to the Grand Canyon?
Yeah.
You got to go. It's awesome. So it says, you know what? I like the Grand Canyon. I'm just going to take a little jump off a 3,000-foot cliff. And then midway down, you know, I decide to use my free will and say, I think I made a bad decision by jumping off the cliff. So I'd like to use my free will now, God, and take back that decision. The answer is no. Sometimes a person makes so many bad decisions that your free will is gone. You don't have it anymore. An alcoholic who decided to take that first shot, the first time, the second time, the 127th time, they were using their free will, but eventually the drug, the addiction takes over and a person doesn't have free will anymore. They use their free will, but it became so corrupted they can't have that. But we have free will. Every one of us here has free will. We can make decisions and we're held accountable for our decisions. That's the healthy way that Hashem runs his universe. But we see things that seem to not make sense to us. There's a famous, two famous stories in the Gemara. There's one person called Nochem Ish Gamzu. Have you heard of Nochem Ish Gamzu? No? So I'll tell you like this. His name was Nochem. His name was not Ish Gamzu, but they nicknamed him that. He's called Ish. The man says Gamzu, which means this is good. Gamzu Latova. Whatever happened, he missed his bus to work. Okay, Gamzu Latova. Got a flat tire. Gamzu Latova. Every single thing that happened to Nachum, he used to say Gamzu Latova. This is good. And he had a student, Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva had a different saying. His statement was not Gamzu Latova. He used to say, I'll translate. He said, Kol ma da'ovid rachman l'tav avid. Everything Hashem does is for the best. And the story has, if you look in the where it says, everything God does is for the good. You see what the Gemara says in number 2, the Gemara in Brachos? Rabbi Akiva was once traveling from one place to another. When he reached a particular town, he looked for an inn in which to dwell, but he found none. He declared this phrase, everything that God does is for the good, right? Kol ma da'ovid rachman l'tav avid. So he went to sleep in the open, accompanied by a cock, a donkey, and a lantern. The wind blew and extinguished the lantern. So that's not so good. The cat came and ate the cock. That's not so good. The lion came and ate the donkey. So now he's out. It's 3 for 3. Yet he declared once again, everything that God does is for the good. On that night, a group of bandits raided the town and took its inhabitants captive. Rabbi Akiva said to his disciples, didn't I tell you that all God does is for the good? So Rashi's commentary says, if the candle was burning or the cock or the donkey would have been alive, Rabbi Akiva would have been discovered and taken captive. So Rabbi Akiva's statement was, everything Hashem does is for the best. And a famous story that, looked like all these setbacks, but really at the end, the following day, he realized that everything was good. So if I were to ask you, these two people, Nachum Ish Gamz, who says everything is good, or Rabbi Akiva, who says that everything Hashem does is for the best, which one is on a higher spiritual level? Nachum Ish Gamzu's statement or Rabbi Akiva's statement? Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva. Why?
Not everything Hashem does is good.
Not everything Hashem does is good.
I mean, it's on a higher level than we want to believe what Rabbi Akiva
says. It believes it's going to be. Okay, you good? Any other thoughts? Tracy, what do you say? It's like class, you get called on. What? What? You think the first one?
Everything is for the good.
So most of the commentators explain like that. That the statement of everything is for the good is a higher level, because Rabbi Akiva, you're right, everything worked out in the end, but that you had to wait till the next day to see that. Whereas Nachum Ish Gamzu, I'm not waiting till 24 hours from now, till 2 weeks from now, till 2 years from now, till 27 years down the future. Right here and now, I can say with certainty, Gamzu L'toyva, this is good. Rabbi Akiva is also very high level. We're not knocking this, but just in terms of saying that this is good, even when I don't see it, I believe that God does only good things. But then again, things that might appear to me to be not so good, a financial setback, a health setback, a person trying to get married, a person trying to have children, how can you say that's good? So that's where Emunah kicks in. When we talk about having Emunah and belief in God, we wouldn't believe in a God that we could understand. That's not called a moon. I don't understand another human being. I have a pretty good relationship with them. I know them quite well. But to say I really understand them, I know what makes them tick, I got them. You can't even say for a human being. So how can we have the chutzpah, the audacity to say that we can understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu? The Kotzke Rebbe said even sharp, he said, I would never believe in a God that I could understand. By definition, we surrender to a higher power and say, I don't understand. There's a certain amount that I can. We have different categories of mitzvos. We have certain mitzvos that are so logical. If Hashem hadn't given them to us, we could have figured them out on our own. I don't need somebody to come and tell me you shouldn't murder. I got that one. That's pretty good. I don't need to say you shouldn't commit adultery. I got that one. You shouldn't steal. I got that one. So there's one category that's so blatantly obvious that we wouldn't really need them to be given. We pretty much would have figured out on our own, right? Second category, which I might not have figured out on my own, but once Hashem gave them to me, I could figure out some reasons behind them. Shabbos. Okay, I can understand an idea about resting, reconnecting, recharging my batteries. I might not have thought of it on my own. Tefillin, spiritual energy to connect to my mind, to my heart, the black boxes we put on. I might not have thought of that on my own, but I could understand it. So I have mitzvos that for sure I could have thought on my own. Mitzvos that maybe yes, maybe no. But there's a third category. There's mitzvos that we have called chukim, laws that don't make any sense. That by definition cannot be explained. You can't explain to why there's a prohibition of mixing wool and linen in the same garment. Shatnez. Paraduma, the red heifer cow that you slaughter it and you burn its ashes, it's to make somebody who's impure becomes pure. Things. There's no logical explanation for these. So why did Hashem do that? Why did Hashem put us in such a situation where some yes, some no? He could have made it all or nothing, right? You understand the power behind the question? Hashem very easily could have changed the way he decided to make his universe. We either understand everything or we understand nothing. But he didn't. There's a sliding scale. There's some things we get right off the bat, some things takes a little while, and some things we just won't ever get. Because that's the definition of what a mitzvah is. I want to show you where this idea comes from. If you look for a minute, look on the bottom page 4. I know I'm skipping around a little bit. So the bottom of page 4 is from Rabbi Yitzchak Kirzner, Olav Shalom. Maybe before we just read this, his quote, a little background. So, for those who have lived in the community longer than me, probably know that Rabbi Kirzner was the original Rav of the Aguda. Before Rabbi Drucker came, Rabbi Kirzner was the original Rav who was hired to be the Rav. I don't know exactly how long, but it wasn't very long because he himself was sick and passed away from a disease. Unbeknownst to the people he was lecturing to, he was talking about his classes on suffering. So here's a person who, as we say, is in the Parsha, is going through it as he's teaching us about what the meaning behind suffering is. So he writes, God in his essence is unknowable, but that doesn't mean he does not exist. The totality of his ways is unfathomable, but it does not mean he has no ways. Intellectual endeavor remains crucial, but it must be coupled with another element, trust. That's what the whole shiur boils down to having emunah in Hashem, even when things are difficult. Trust is what we're left with when we've gone as far as we can towards intellectual understanding and have still not obtained satisfactory answers. Trust is a certainty that there's a sense to God's ways even when we're denied access to those ways. There's questions that we have. Whether they're valid questions or invalid questions, doesn't really matter. We have questions in our mind. And where those questions come from and what stage of the life we're at when we ask those questions, says Rabbi Kirzner, Olav Shalom, that we have to step back and understand, just because we don't understand, we can't understand it, it doesn't mean there isn't an answer. God could have created us with the intellectual capacity to understand every mitzvah, including the chukim, right, which we talked about, the ones that are beyond understanding, or he could have limited the Torah to only those mitzvahs that were capable of understanding, the edus and the mishpatim, those are the first two categories, but he did neither. Rather, he gave us the chukim to introduce the element of trust into our relationship with him. We don't understand them, we observe them because we trust him. And that's really what we use to give ourselves strength during difficult times. Our trust and our belief, to quote Albert Einstein, God's not playing dice with the universe, right? God doesn't play dice with me and you. Hashem controls every single event in this world. When a leaf falls, whether the leaf falls this way or whether the leaf falls this way, that's all from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's all Hashem's plan. And if Hashem cares that much about a little leaf, about a speck of dirt, how much more so he cares about us, the Jewish people? So part of the idea that we strengthen ourselves in is that there is suffering, there is difficulties, but there's a reason behind it. Now, we're not able to take each and every single person and say, well, this is why it's happening. We don't know that. Anybody who tells you that they know why this is happening, check their credentials, because unless they have a hotline to heaven, Judaism doesn't work that way. There might be very big tzaddik and very great people who could, but the majority are not like that. We have to examine ourselves, and every single one of us has room for improvement. So we think about, am I doing as much chesed, much acts of kindness? Am I giving enough tzedakah that I really should be doing? Am I praying as much as I should? Is my Shabbos the way it should be? We think about these things, and we look for areas of improvement, but we don't know the answer. It's all about having a moon and believing. And yes, there are difficult times. But the difficulties are really there for our benefit. See, you know, I think we've discussed this in previous classes over the years, about why Hashem gives us tests. So you'll correct me if I haven't, maybe I said this before, but if not, it's worthwhile to repeat it again. If I did say it, the idea of the Ramban. The Ramban writes in what could be arguably the hardest challenge a human being ever has to go is when Avram is asked to sacrifice his son Yitzchak. The Akedah. And Avraham agrees. So Ramban asks, he says, "V'nisa Hashem is Avraham." Hashem tested Avraham. So the Ramban says, why do you have to test? God is all-knowing. God knows everything, right? So when God, who knows everything, why does he have to test us? If you're a human being, I'm a teacher, so I give a test. I have to know, does this kid remember the quadratic formula? Do they not know the quadratic formula? So I got to make, like, you know, 17 annoying problems to figure out the kid really knows the quadratic formula. Did they memorize, you know, the states and all their capitals? So I got to make a whole chart and a PowerPoint presentation to test them to find out. Because I'm the teacher, they're the student, and I don't know. So I give them a test, and they spit back the information. They show, oh, wow, okay, Bobby knows. He knows his capitals. He gets an A+. I'll go to an Ivy League school. Mazel tov. But that's a teacher, okay. But God knows. So why does he test us? Says the Ramban, the reason why Hashem gives us a test is for our own benefit. Because when we're put into a difficult situation, and we don't ask, we never, ever, ever ask to be tested. But when we do have a test, we have a nisayon. So we dig deep. And we pull upon resources that we didn't think were accessible to us. Because we were in a difficult situation, we had to pull out of ourselves latent powers, kochos that we didn't know we had inside of us, but we rise to the occasion. Remember when I was a kid in suffering through one of my history classes in elementary school, my teacher made, she didn't know, it was called a chakira. It means the two ways of looking at something. She asked the following question. I thought it was a good question. She just said like this. She wasn't Rosh Hashiva, but she wanted to be like, you know, alumnus. She said, when the American Revolution happened, was it because we had such great leaders in America at that time, right? And therefore, that's why everything is? Or was it no, that if these great leaders had not all been around there, then they wouldn't have been such, you know, fabulous people, just because they happened to be all living in that time period. So was it the people who caused it, or was it the events that did it? In other words, she was trying to ask, if it would be just a bunch of mediocre people, would they have still written a constitution? And because it was such difficult times they were living in, they rose to the occasion. They wrote the Constitution, and they created these fantastic forms of government that we have nowadays, because the situation caused people to rise to it. Right? Abraham Lincoln had one of the most difficult presidencies, but he became a hero because of the way he rose to the occasion. Lubavitcher Rebbe once described him as a disciple. He called one of the Hasidim Umas HaOlam, one of the pious non-Jews of the world, was Abraham Lincoln. Because situations call upon us to rise to the occasion, and that's how we're judged by. That's the ultimate stand we hold ourselves to. Do we dig deep when we have a test, or do we decide to run away and cuddle up in the covers and go back to sleep, hit the snooze button? So those are the decisions that we make. I'm not sure how much time. We have a few more minutes? Yeah, okay. Are there any questions so far? I know I've been talking a lot. Any questions so far, what we're saying? Okay. Let's go through a few more sources. Yeah, question? No? Okay. On the next page, Ricky, no? Do you want to ask her a question for her? I don't mind being challenged.
That's okay.
Okay. So we'll go back to the Ramchal from here on the top of page 5. Discussing what the purpose, you know, is, suffering, etc. So he says, this is in Derech Hashem, again, the same work that we quoted at the very beginning. Good deeds incorporate an intrinsic quality of perfection, excellence unto man's body and soul. Evil deeds, on the other hand, incorporate a quality of insensitivity and deficiency, all with a precise measure depending on the deeds. God gave suffering the power to dispel the insensitivity in man, allowing him to become pure and clear. So when we go through difficult times and suffering, that certainly purifies us and makes us into more sensitive people. I happen to know a person, and I, again, you have to try to judge everybody favorably, but the guy was not nice. He was like one of these hotshot lawyers in Manhattan. And the guy just, to be frankly, he was a jerk. He was just not a nice person. And he went years this way. Years and years this way. Then his health took a turn. And he said to my father, Olav Hashem, he says, I think Hashem is punishing me for being in his own, for being such a jerk all these years. Now, if he hadn't suffered, he probably would have gone. I don't even know where he is. I don't know if he's alive or not. He should live and be well, but I don't know his life story anymore. But if he hadn't gone through that period of suffering, he would have continued to go around cursing out all these people and just being a mean, nasty individual. But then when he gets hit with something, he stops and thinks. The suffering, the difficulties, make me realize, why is this happening? So it brings us to a certain place of humility. So you could ask, well, what do I need to suffer? I could just be a humble person without suffering. That's true. But certainly when a person does suffering, that does bring us to a certain state. Now, suffering is very relative. There's like extreme suffering, and there's just, we'll call, minor annoyances. The Gemara says that one form of suffering is, you know, when you're in your hand and you need a quarter, like I said, you pull out like a dime. Ugh, wow, what a rough day at work. I pulled out a dime and I needed a quarter, so now I'm 15 cents short. Says the Gemara, when you pull out the wrong coin out of your pocket, that's also called suffering. If you look the more in Erech in the next source, how far does the idea of atonement achieved through suffering go? So Belazar said, even if someone bought a suit and it doesn't fit exactly, okay, so nowadays we'll just take it back. Anyway, he wanted a cup of hot drink, right, Amazon, you can take like anything nowadays. He wanted a hot drink, but it was a cold one or vice versa. Accidentally puts their clothes on backwards. Even he reaches into a pocket for 3 coins, but pulls out 2. That's also suffering. So every little bit of suffering is a kapara, is an atonement. It brings us to that. So you say, look, I don't need this kapara. I don't need to be such a refined person. I'm happy to just be with, you know, I want to be a regular, run-of-the-mill person. Don't give me no suffering. Don't give me no reward. Just let me live my life. So I want to share a story I said a few weeks over on Shabbos morning, a few weeks ago in the Drusha. There was a man who lived in the times of the Chafetz Chaim. And he was struggling financially. And he wanted to make a deal. Now the Gemara says in Kiddushin, the Gemara says that there's no reward for mitzvos in this world. There's a phrase called Schar Mitzvah Hayam Aleika. You don't get rewarded for the mitzvahs. The mitzvahs, we're going to get rewarded. Like we said from the very beginning, we believe 100% that no good deed will ever not go rewarded, and no not nice deed will never not punished. There's reward and punishment, 100%. But where does that happen? So it could happen in the next world. So this guy wanted to make a deal. I say the bracha after using the bathroom. Asher Yatzar. God, you helped me, you made my body function in a healthy way. I was able to go to the bathroom. It's a bracha that we say every time after using the restroom. Said, look, I want to make a trade. I want the reward for one time, one bracha. I want that, and I'll get the reward in this world. So again, I don't have to be rich, right? Like Tevye, I don't have to be a rich man. I just don't want to be poor anymore. I don't want to struggle. It's hard. So he wants to make this deal to trade in his reward for one Asher Yatzer in exchange for some little finances in this world. But he realizes that he doesn't have any protexia in Shemayim. You can't just make such a contract and God's going to agree to it. So he goes to the Chafetz Chaim, the greatest rabbi in the generation. Because Chafetz Chaim talks down here, they listen upstairs. So he says to the rabbi of the Chafetz Chaim, look, I need you got protexia. I want to make this deal. I want cash in. I want an early advance, right? I want one Asher Yatzer, not to be poor anymore, and then the rest, I'll take all the reward, anything else, all the good deeds I've done, I'll get those in the next world. But I need something right here and now. The Chafetz Chaim said to him, he says, my entire kin, my sweet child, let me give you a parable. Imagine a kid has a bar mitzvah. And, you know, for what's a typical bar mitzvah gift? You give the kid a chumash, you give them a kiddush cup, you give them a machzor. So the kid has a rich uncle. So the kid's rich uncle for his bar mitzvah gives him a check for $500,000. Not bad. And he says, look, you don't understand the value of this check. Hold on to it. When you get older, more mature, more sensitive, more intelligent, you'll understand what the value of this gift I'm giving to you right now is. Don't do anything with it. Just hold on to it until a later time. So the kid's a kid. So he takes his check for $500,000 and he goes to the local candy store. And he says, you know, I'd like a bag of Nosh, right? Everyone knows what Nosh is, right? I want some junk food. So the store owner looks and says, you know, I can't break this check for you. I can't cash this check for you. The kid says, keep the change. So if the store owner is a normal Ehrlich person, he'll say to him, look, kid, don't buy the candy bag, take back your check, go home, sit on it for a few years, and eventually understand what a favor I'm doing you right now by not taking your check from him. If the guy's not so honest, not so straightforward, he'll say, well, okay, you give me a check, take 2 bags of Nosh, right? It's on me, right? Said the Chafetz Chaim to this man, you're worse than the kid in the candy store. You don't understand what it means to get reward for one single mitzvah. When the Gemara tells us that there's no reward for mitzvahs in this world, that means imagine all of the wealth that this world has to offer. Imagine your $10 million yacht, right? Your mansion, your plasma television screens and all your cars and all your things. Imagine Bill Gates and all of his chavra, right? All those guys. What they have is not worth one Asher Yatzar. Every time a Jew does a mitzvah, Every time we say a bracha, every time we eat kosher, every time we light Shabbos candles, every time man puts on tefillin, there's not enough wealth in this world to pay back for that one action. And if we think, okay, so we'll sell it short now, we're like a kid. We don't understand what it means to have the value of a mitzvah. So talk about, oh, I'm suffering now. Yeah, we could be suffering now. But you know why sometimes these evil people have a good life right now? Because their entire next world is being wiped out and they're getting a little bit now. They're getting a nice car. They're getting a big house. They're getting the easy life right now because there's gurnish, there's nothing waiting for them in the next world. And we believe 100% there's an Olam Haba, there's a world to come. And nothing is ever forgotten. As we say in the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur davening, Hashem doesn't forget a single thing we do. Everything is written down. Everything is remembered. Imagine a Jew living like 1,000 years ago. You mean what? Everything's written down? You have some way of storing so much information? Now we look at Google and we understand how you can store so much information. God's constantly making inventions that we can understand even better how He runs His world. Every step we're taking, every new invention that God allows to be created, scientists don't make anything new. They use the same scientific principles that have been here since the 6 days of creation. Just Hashem decides at what point in history He wants to allow them the insights to make a certain invention. So all the things that are being created and discovered and they're fantastic. But it's here just to bring us closer to Hashem. So we talk about the world to come and the suffering. It puts it all into context. We understand what it really means, the value of a mitzvah in this world. I just want one last point to try to cover on the last page. I think we discussed this in our classes on reincarnation. I believe we did. What hurts us most, as we said at the beginning, very beginning, is not when a terrible person, you know, suffers. Yasser Arafat, Al Capone, gangsters, all these terrible, terrible people. That doesn't bother us. What bothers us, what tears us apart is when you see a child, a good person. Good person is suffering. So we have to believe that this isn't our first stop, our first visit here. Every single one of us is a neshama, a soul that's, for better word term, recycled. We've been here before. This is not our first journey into the world. And that's the idea of reincarnation, which is a fundamental of the Vilna Gaon. We quoted the Ramban writes like the Arizal. We have many, many sources. It's not a non-Jewish topic. This is a very much a Jewish idea of reincarnation. And when we see what, to our perception, from our limited perception, seems like good people suffering, we take chizuk in the fact that there's a plan. There's an all-powerful God, an all-knowing God, and a God who's by definition all good. A God who by definition only wants what's best for all of us. But from our limited perspective, it seems to be not good. So says the Ramchal, a single soul could reincarnate a number of times in different bodies in this manner, could rectify the damage done in previous incarnations. Similarly, it can also achieve perfection that was not attained in previous incarnations. The soul is ultimately judged at the end of all these incarnations. Its judgment will depend on everything that took place in all its incarnations, as well as its status as an individual in each one. When an individual has a reincarnated soul, it's possible he'll be affected in a particular manner as a result of his deeds in a previous incarnation. The situation which he's placed may follow from this, and this situation may bring with it the special responsibility given to him. As we said earlier, that each one of us didn't pick our personality traits. I have a temper. I was born with a temper. It's a family tradition. My father had a temper. My grandfather had a temper. We have tempers. That's who we are. You have a temper because that didn't get fixed in a previous lifetime. So Hashem sends us in this world with a temper now, so we have to try to, again, temper, just fill in the blank. I have an ego, I have anger, I have jealousy, whatever character traits we're working on. And we all have what to work on. Because we didn't yet fix these quality traits. And it could very well be, if a young child comes into the world for a short period of time, a few months, could be because they'd fixed basically every single thing else and just had one small little polishing of a button that needed to be corrected, and then their soul had reached its complete perfection. I don't know anyone's personal stories here, but a friend of mine, Rabbi Zev Reichman, once, he's a rabbi in Inglewood, and unfortunately a family in his community had a child that passed away very early. And he went to visit them at Columbia Presbyterian. He told them this concept. They'd never heard of reincarnation. just didn't know about that. When they told him afterwards, they received a tremendous amount of comfort from knowing this, that perhaps this idea that of reincarnation gave them an insight as to why their child only came into this world for a very brief period of time. But the rule is, we all have a mission, we all have a divine purpose, and we think about that, we reflect upon that, it doesn't make the suffering any easier. What it does do, it gives us the tools and the perspective to strengthen ourselves and to stand strong. It doesn't take away the suffering. What it does, it makes it manageable. And ultimately, if we think about it and reframe it in the positive light, we understand it's really for our own good. Why that is, we don't know. Is that even a fair question to ask? I don't know. But it is what it is. And these are what the sources have to say about how to overcome adversity and how to receive strength. So hopefully it was able to give some strength, to give a little chizuk, a little emuna. And I invite this as to be part of a continuing conversation when we meet again. Thank you already for coming out.